An exhibition at Wellington City Gallery is about sound, what it can mean and what its absence can indicate, and how we overhear in both meanings of that word. It features work by international artists and it has been curated by James Parker of the University of Melbourne Law School and Joel Stern, Artistic Director of Liquid Architecture, which is an Australian organisation engaged in sonic experience. The exhibition is called Eavesdropping. You can see some works from it on our webpage, and both James Parker and Joel Stern are here. Hi.
Hello.
Really interesting exhibition. Can you tell me how it first came about? You've got these relatively disparate artists you've brought together to convey this concept of hearing, eavesdropping. How did you get it together?
The project didn't really start life as an exhibition. It started as a conversation, a kind of open conversation between James and I, in which we were kind of exploring the intersections between our interests in sound and listening, experimental kind of sonic experiences, but also politics and law and ethics. And it was really in these sort of disciplinary intersections that we came upon the term eavesdropping as a way to hold our interests together.
Yeah.
And when we first started thinking about that term, it was not kind of already with an exhibition in mind. It was sort of more just as a point of departure for thinking about projects. They could be performances, they could be sort of writing projects, they could be conversations with artists. But there was actually an invitation from the Ian Potter Museum in Melbourne, which kind of kick-started this project, or at least accelerated it, and it started to take shape as an exhibition and has really gone from there.
So your first thought, I don't know whether you can go to this, James, because of your work in the law aspect, your first thought about eavesdropping was surveillance?
I think that's the most common contemporary association. I know I was certainly thinking of Snowden. I don't know if people have seen the word used in relation to these kind of increasingly ubiquitous home assistants, you know, Siri and everything. There's articles on a daily basis, you know, is Apple eavesdropping on you? And likewise, it's used all the time in relation to, you know, global surveillance networks. But when I started to look into the history of that term from a legal perspective, it quickly became clear that it's a word that has a long legal history, actually. So eavesdropping begins in about the word starts to be used in about the 14th, 15th century in England to describe the practice of listening under the eaves of a house, right, in these sort of very small villages in England. And that's when the word first begins to be used to name an offence, the act of listening under the eaves of a house, and at that time with the intent of spreading gossip.
That's the criminal bit, isn't it? Just listening isn't the crime. The eavesdropping implied to disseminate it with, you know, mischievous or slanderous intent.
That's right. Although, you know, that's not the association that we have today. And one of the things we're interested in the show is exploring and almost kind of expanding, thinking with eavesdropping in a kind of an expansive way that draws in as many things as possible. So one of the nice things about flipping from surveillance, you know, which is kind of implies a top-down direction, to this sort of old historical usage of the word, is that you're suddenly dealing with a kind of a more interpersonal form of eavesdropping. And then once you start thinking that way, you think, okay, well, the old version of eavesdropping involves walls and windows. What are the technological mediations of contemporary eavesdropping? Is it, you know, surveillance infrastructures? Is it telephones and wiretapping? There's a long history, particularly in the US, of the use of the word eavesdropping to refer to wiretapping practices. And many of those kind of dynamics, different dynamics, are represented in the show in different ways.
I want to talk about an artist called Lawrence Abdu Hamdan shortly, but I just want, in the wake of what you've just said, James, I want to talk about Susan Shupley's exhibition, because it seems to be a collection of old answering machines which came with the tapes that people left in. So she set up answering machine messages and whole conversations if you don't press the button fast enough, you get the whole conversation recorded, which is not, strictly speaking, legal, I would have thought, to have these on show and on air.
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. there's a book that accompanies this exhibition, and in it, Susan has an essay in which she explores the kind of complex and quite subtle ethical and legal dimensions of this work. So, you know, the thing is, these tapes were abandoned, and they're abandoned in different jurisdictions across the US and Canada particularly. And so each of those jurisdictions will have its own laws in relation to, you know, the laws of abandonment. And so it's at least very complicated and probably not illegal, but it does feel...
illicit.
Yeah, a bit voyeuristic. And actually, that's one of the only works in the show that really situates the gallery goer in the position of the eavesdropper. You know, you there's 25 hours worth of recordings. You know, you put your ear, you tune in, and it does. There is a sort of a little bit of a friction, right? When you can't help but think to yourself, is this for me? Was this ever imagined as being for me? But actually, the work, in a way, is not so much about the private lives of these individuals, but more about the kind of the passing into history in, of this whole medium of communication. And when you listen at length to these recordings, you quickly realize that people talk in very specific ways as they're kind of invited to by the machine. The forms of listening and speaking and the kind of the mechanical sounds and the beeps, they're very specific. And you know, some of us are old enough to remember those things, but you know, they're gone, and the work has almost kind of got a mournful tone in some ways, sort of remembering and sort of paying homage to this kind of this increasingly obsolete medium.
Some of us are old enough to remember the idea that we all took for granted, I think, at some stage, of the switchboard operator listening into your conversation. Anyway, you know, I mean, it was we've become more sensitized to the idea of eavesdropping in privacy, obviously, as we become more technologically able on it. I wanted to ask you, Joel, we haven't got a picture of this, but it's an extraordinary thing. It's a choir. It's a work by Samson Young, and it's a video of a choir of whispering voices based on the music of Bach. And another composer whose name I can't immediately bring to mind.
Antonio Lotti.
And it's... Can you describe it? Because it's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, I mean, a bit of background. It's part of a series of works called Muted Situations. And this artist, Samson Young, he's very interested in muting, I suppose, as opposed to silence. So, you know, the idea of silence is kind of the absence of sound or a kind of nothingness. But in muting, you're taking something that is there and you're kind of pressing it down or repressing it or removing
something. And bringing something else up.
That's right. And one of the things that sort of is important about this work is to note that in any act of muting, something else is amplified. So, you know, the work is both about what is sort of pushed down, but then what is brought into the foreground by that. And the Muted Situations series has a whole lot of different situations that Samson applies this muting kind of method to. And they usually take the form of videos, so they're quite sort of theatrical works. And, you know, some of them have involved like boxing matches or traditional Chinese dance in which sounds that we would usually associate with those events are kind of repressed. But a number of them are musical, and that belies Samson's background as a composer. He trained at the conservatorium in Sydney, in fact. He's based in Hong Kong, as you mentioned, but he's got a very strong interest in the way in which the sort of European and American classical music canon circulates in the East, in Asia, and kind of the way in which Asian composers, like himself, as he has put it, are invisible in their own concert halls or inaudible in their own concert halls, the way that the sort of European avant-garde and its canonical gestures sort of have come to dominate. So one of the really important references in the work that's in the show, Music muted chorus in which, you know, as you described, there's a whispering choir who've been instructed to perform the pieces by Lotti and Bach, but with the melodies and the notes and essentially the voices removed. And what that leaves is a kind of unvoiced whisper. But another really important reference for that is John Cage's famous work, 4 minutes 33, which is a sort of, you know, usually referred to as the silent work in which a musician, usually a pianist, sits and sort of doesn't make a sound for, you know, 4.5 odd minutes. And the audience is sort of supposed to become aware of the silence and aware of the silence as a kind of, I suppose, a sonic event in and of itself. And, you know, I think one of the things that Samson is doing is really applying a different kind of, you know, method to these questions of silence. In his work, you know, both what is repressed and what is revealed kind of have equal weight. And we don't sort of see that silence, you know, only as a liberatory kind of gesture that opens up the silence, but we kind of also feel the weight of and the heaviness of the thing that has sort of been repressed and its impact. So I mean, I think
can't help asking if he's based in Hong Kong, using the words repression and silence, and what is outspoken? Is he involved in the protests?
Yeah, I mean, I hope he's safe and well is the first thing to say. But you know, Samson is a very politically engaged artist, and you know, like very many younger artists working in Hong Kong, the politics of the relationship with China and the region is really central to his work. But he's also a very poetic artist, and I think, you know, a number of the works in Eavesdropping are explicitly political works, and I know we'll discuss some of them. And this is probably the only work that comes out of a musical lineage, and its references are to the history of music and to musical performance. So it's one of the more overtly poetic works in the show.
Let's talk about some of those political ones. And I mentioned Lawrence Abu Hamdan, who is a kind of a linchpin of the whole exhibition. He's got a work, for example, called Rubber Coated Steel, which was based on Israeli soldiers. Whether Israeli soldiers, because I don't know whether it was proven or not, James, you probably know, used rubber bullet adapters to suppress the sound of live bullets, which killed at least two young Palestinians. What's the verdict on that?
I mean, that's the apposite word, because the this work in particular, but actually all of Lawrence's work, deals overtly with legal questions, and it works often in the idiom of law and appropriates legal techniques, forensic techniques. Lawrence has often referred to himself as a forensic listener, and he's associated with the organisation Forensic Architecture. But the Rubber Coated Steel does sort of attempt to deliver a verdict. It's a video work, but it's in the form of a mock trial. Now, this trial never took place, but Lawrence is very good in his kind of understanding of legal rhetoric and the dialogue between prosecution and defence and judge and witness and so on. And so the form of the work is about the delivery of a verdict.
But the substance of the work came from a report.
Exactly.
Right, he's not making it up.
No, that's right. Exactly right. So what happened was Forensic Architecture was commissioned to produce a report and an inquiry into this shooting of the Palestinian teenager, which just so happened to have caught, I think a CNN crew happened to have captured the audio of the alleged shooting. And so Lawrence did the audio ballistics for that report, and the report was issued, and that report in fact led to the indictment of one of the soldiers, because Lawrence and the report were able to show from the audio ballistics that this must have been a rubber-coated steel bullet. And so
so it was a deliberate attempt to disguise the fact that they had killer bullets as opposed to warning
bullets.
That's
exactly right. Mm. And the first time that work was presented, actually, you know, that was the end of the story, that the soldier had been indicted, and it was kind of a bit of a triumphalist, story in some ways. You know, art and, you know, forensic architecture come in to, you know, do something in law, and that's true. But actually, subsequently, and by the time this work was first exhibited in Melbourne and now here, the soldier in question had pled guilty and had a very, very light sentence, a sort of negligible sentence in the end handed down. So it's not to say that the work was futile, but it takes on a slightly different political and legal meaning when you understand that history.
I was reading, James, about the work that you did on acoustic jurisprudence, specifically with regard to a trial of a man accused by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda of inciting genocide with songs.
That's right.
I can understand the arty sense of acoustic jurisprudence, but why would you need acoustic jurisprudence? Why is that different from a man accused of inciting genocide with words? What's the difference?
That's sort of precisely the question, honestly, that in the book, I sort of make the claim that this trial, this tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, sort of wasn't very good at, and in some respects, not very interested in asking those kinds of questions. So there were all sorts of sort of assumptions and claims, not just about, you know, what the difference is between a song and a spoken text, but about what it means to speak in person or on the radio, and what it means to listen to a song in a radio, and what is a radio listenership, and so on and so on. And they're just sort of unarticulated. And actually, these are very complicated questions. And some of the moves that the tribunal makes that are really determinative in its decision. So it constantly talks, for example, about the score of the music, as if the music, which is sort of a very sort of Western way of thinking about the composition of music and so on. But there's lots more to say. But there are just all these kind of uninterrogated assumptions that are doing a lot of work in the context of that trial. But actually, the aspect of that whole project that sort of led to Joel and I working together in some ways was more to do with the trial as an acoustic space. And this is something that people are very familiar with, I think, the idea that a court involves certain ways of giving voice to testimony, certain ways of listening. Increasingly, headphones are present in the courtroom. Mm. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda involves simultaneous interpretation. So there's many different languages going on at the same time and so on. And so one of the other parts of the book was to think about the tribunal as an acoustic space. And so, you know, once you start thinking that way, well, you think, well, how is a courtroom, you know, similar to a gallery or a concert hall? And one of the things that we're doing with this show is to sort of reverse that and to say, well, what if we think about the gallery as also a law school or a space in which justice or sort of faculties of judgment are shaped and tuned and so on?
It's certainly very, I mean, for example, I know you commissioned, I think, the Sounds from Manus Island work, where 8 Manus Island men made recordings made on devices smuggled onto the island. They could record anything they liked. And you've got, for example, one of them walking through a forest. So essentially, from the verbal point of view, silent. But so not silent. And it's strangely moving. Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's moving for a number of reasons.
Well, moving, obviously.
Yeah.
Because he's walking. Carry on.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's one of the senses in which it's moving. But, you really can't listen to those recordings, of which there are 84 10-minute recordings, totaling 14 hours, made by 6 men in detention.
6 men.
On Manus Island. I mean, you can't listen to the recordings and the sounds that are sort of captured within them without also thinking about the context in which they were recorded. The
sheer weight of time that
right.
they have to spend as well. That's the impression that you would get.
That's right. I mean, what those recordings signify, what they mean, what we're listening to when we listen to them is so much more than just the sound contained in those 10-minute excerpts. Of course, when you listen to 10 minutes of time spent in detention on Manus through an audio recording, you're also listening in a way to the 23 hours and 50 minutes of the day that wasn't recorded, and the 6 years now of indefinite detention, ongoing detention, that hasn't been captured. So it's a work that produces a very extensive audio archive for 14 hours, as I mentioned, but that's a tiny fraction of the total time. And, you know, I think the question of how to listen to those recordings is a really complex one. As you mentioned, the men who were given field recording devices, small portable field recording devices, were not instructed on what to record. Although there was a lot of dialogue leading up to the production of that work between the six men on Manus and three collaborators in Melbourne who have prior relationships and sort of collaborative work with these guys. But those discussions were sort of around the kind of conceptual approach to capturing day-to-day life as opposed to what specifically to record or not to record. And, you know, so as a result, the range in the recordings is really massive. You know, there are some of the recordings are extremely eventful, as in sort of we can hear numerous discrete sort of things happening, conversations in the foreground and background, or it's very clear why the recording has focused on a particular time and place. Some are sort of first person addresses to the listener, sort of in which the recorder introduces himself and explains what we're about to hear. Mm-hmm. And others, like the recording, which I think is by Behrouz Bouchani, who is, you know, in the last year won numerous literary prizes and been recognised for his writing and journalism. Some of his recordings, perhaps ironically for a person who is so articulate and has written so much and has so much to say, many of his recordings are close to sort of ambient in that they record the sounds of the jungle.
That's the forest walk, isn't it?
The forest walk, and he made sort of numerous recordings in which you could say most of the action happens in the background. But I think one of the important reasons for that and one of the motivating factors for that project is that, you know, forcing these refugees detained in Manus to sort of narrativise and retell over and over the story of their detention, of the injustice and of their experience to sort of do that in words. In some ways, that has been sort of said over and over to little effect, and there's a degree of fatigue there. And
That's quite right. It's a refresh button being pressed on it. I want to get back to Lawrence Abdulhamdan because we've only got 2 minutes left.
I see.
And he's got a huge can of opus going on here. Mm. But one of the things that he has, and we've got it on our website, is a map of violent incidents in Somalia. Mm. And it's what he's suggesting is the impact on the voices of the people from Somalia in order to convey the inadequacy of voice to convey the truth of the situation because of language analysis to prove origins of asylum seekers. And I just wanted one of you to talk to this map of conflicted phonemes we've got here.
Yeah, I'll have a go. So listeners may not be aware that when asylum seekers claim asylum, one technique that's been used by many governments around the world to determine whether or not they are really from where they say they are is to do accent testing. And this accent testing is sort of based in a kind of intuition we have that we can tell, you know, that you might be able to tell that I have an English accent, right? It's sort of intuitively correct. You know, do you say tomato or tomato? But it turns out that that practice is much more complicated than it sort of first seems, and especially if you're a refugee, especially if you're from a place that has been war-torn and that's had sort of very complex and subtle, you know, movements and sort of...
And along the top of this, he's got, I can barely read it, ethno... ethno-Somali war, and there's, you know, there's all sorts of atrocities going on the front. And underneath it, we've got this, you know, careful measurement.
That's right.
It's so, wonderful.
So the work sort of, which is this kind of map, is sort of meant to be illegible in a certain kind of way, in order to convey precisely that complexity.
Yeah. And I think, Joel, you said that he'd been shortlisted for the Turner, did you?
Yeah,
it'd Lawrence, be interesting to see.
He is a nominee for the Turner Prize.
Thank you. Talking about with Joel Stern and James Parker, the exhibition at the City Gallery in Wellington,